must perform a symbolic motion. A motion which, however, reveals by its instinctual direction and quality that it bears witness to a moving conviction. Conviction leading to motion moves man, and this motion is the thing which must take place in order for a condition or level of experience to be changed. Thus, to Hermes, the search for truth must involve a motion. It must involve a movement. We can think of this motion as spiritual. We can think of it as psychological. But it must receive the peculiar seal of action. Perhaps this again, as the Egyptians pointed out, has something to do with the sensory perceptions. A motion which does not include them is not a complete motion. A motion in which man moves inwardly away from them, without including them, without considering them, without giving to the body and its various aspects the proper opportunity to worship its own superior. Failure to give this opportunity leaves virtue imperfect and prevents man from a completely holistic adjustment. This again would have some conflict perhaps with some theological systems, for man has thought of moving away from body, of transferring allegiances from body to consciousness or to mind. He has hoped that perhaps he could leave this body behind like some empty shell upon the shores of the sea of time. Hermes says, no, the body cannot be left behind. The body is the younger brother who must be carried along. We must take the body by the hand and lead it with us, for it has a destiny of us and in us. It has a kind of contribution to make. And perhaps this was the secret of the Hermetic science adapted to the speculations of alchemy. For in alchemy there was distinct emphasis upon the importance of the most neglected of all elements. One of the early Hermetic alchemists said that those who seek the mysterious magical agent, the proper material, the first material of the wise man's stone, nearly always fail to find it because they look for it in distant and difficult places. Another writer says, those who would achieve the great elixir, the universal medicine, must realize that its basic material is with them from the cradle to the grave, that it is never distant from them, that it is nearer to them than any other object that exists in nature. And this same writer says that even more humble than this, the very excrement from this near thing is richer than any foreign substance if we seek the material of the stone. The only possible implication from this is that in some way the basic material of the Hermetic mystery must be man's body. It is the only thing which can answer the requirements of the various definitions that are given. This mysterious thing must be physical. It must be composed of elements. It must contain within itself the seeds of life. It must have motion and animation. And it must be closer to man than anything except his own soul. The implications become increasingly obvious, for the only thing that can be so close and still physical must be the body. And the experimentations as they unfold justifies this thought. Therefore, in the Hermetic mystery, body has something to do with the regeneration or perfection of man. It is true in the Hermetic arts that it is the power of the mind to protect and preserve body. But it is not necessarily true that the body can make no contribution to this larger purpose. In his discourse to his son Tatian, Hermes explains that the humblest of things must not be left out. For as surely as the great may contribute to the greatness of things, so surely that which is most humble, that which is least of all, must likewise contribute, or completeness cannot follow. What then can the body contribute? And here Hermes gives us a few more rather interesting pointers. Body can contribute symbolism. It can contribute a kind of action, an action perfected by art, an action which we find perhaps most nearly approached in the artistic canons of men like Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo never regarded the body merely as the house of life. He examined it. He measured it. He estimated it. He came to numerous subtle calculations. He divided it into an infinite number of parts, these in turn divisible. He originated a concept of the ultimate eternal repetition of parts, a concept which has been preserved to us in the theory of dynamic symmetry. Namely and factually, every part of the body blazes forth with the emblems of universal law. And like the mysterious vision of the Greek philosopher, it stands as an heroic figure, its body covered with letters of fire, and its entire structure held within a strange framework of geometry. This body, then, must make its own peculiar contribution. For as surely as the image, because it is held sacred, may have a virtue, so surely the body, recognized in its true nature, has a virtue. And one of the virtues of the body is its power to release man through an experience of total body consciousness. Now, this is not necessarily consciousness of body. But man has been given several books, even from the Hermetic Arcanum, by which he may know the divine. One of these books is nature, one is Holy Writ, and one the human body itself. Paracelsus said, if man would be wise, he must study his own body. For the proper study for mankind is man as a total experience. Hermes was convinced that the body was a kind of magical formula, and that those who could read it rightly and use it properly possessed a secret knowledge not to be otherwise attained. Furthermore, this body, acting, brought into motion under law and by consciousness, assumed certain attitudes, became mathematically and harmonically adjusted. Much of this is contained in the abstract concepts of Hatha Yoga, where there is a peculiar and particular virtue in the positions of the body in relation to health, and also in relation to consciousness. And the body, assuming certain postures, and brought into a certain degree of refinement, and brought under a certain mastery by consciousness, becomes an indispensable part in the accurate and correct performance of the Hatha Yogic disciplines. In other words, it would be fair to say that certain spiritual ends attained by Hatha Yoga could not be attained if the person practicing it was not embodied. There was an ancient Egyptian adage that all new experience must come to man during embodiment, and that in the periods between embodiments, he reflected and gradually assimilated and digested experience and built it into power. but that new experience must come through body. And therefore that the release of man into certain levels of conscious experience also required the cooperation of body. Thus man not only must redeem life, but he must also redeem body, for body is merely a form of life. And just as surely as man is a citizen of a divine empire, he has another empire over which he is master. Let us assume for a moment the Hermetic axiom, which is derived from the Babylonian Hermes, Nebo, who was called the god of the writing table. This deity paralleled very much the thinking of the famous Hermetic axiom that was written on the emerald tablet of Hebron. On this tablet it was stated that all superior things are like unto inferiors, that all inferior things are like unto superiors, that things differing in multitude and magnitude are still bound together by a common sympathy of design which is indissoluble. By the same token, Nebo says, that which has been shall be. That which is somewhere is everywhere. Therefore man, recognizing himself as a citizen of the infinite, views himself as one small part of a great empire. He looks around him and beholds a total population of creatures like or similar to himself. He also perceives other species and genera different from himself. And he becomes aware of many creations abiding around him. And he sees himself as a citizen of a vast form, a great body, with its roots in space and its branches unfolding into the mystery of time and generation. So surely, as man is a citizen of a greater empire, so man is master of a lesser empire. It would be as wrong for man to depart from the empire of his own body as it would be for God to depart from the empire of space, and equally impossible. Now all beings have natural approach and departure from formal matters, but in the inner constitution of man, those years which constitute his normal span represent a vast cycle of growth and opportunity for the creatures that are his citizens, the creatures of his world. And these creatures are not only the visible creatures or those which can be estimated by scientific means, not only the various cells and atoms, but invisible creatures inhabiting galaxies of these atoms, beings so vast that they themselves are godlings, ruling over orders of cells and ruling over orders of processes, and serving faithfully as superintendents and overseers, guarding the functions and the restorations of the human body. These lives are not separate from man. He furnishes them an embodiment. But if they become disembodied, they do not die, nor do they depart from man, but they return to man, and they await re-embodiment. Thus there is a vast evolutionary process in which the body plays a part. And man cannot escape from the evolution of the cell life within himself. His release results from his releasing those things that are parts of himself. Therefore his emancipation, his final liberation from his humanity, means that he has also brought up to a certain level of attainment, to a degree of revelation and liberation suitable to themselves, all the life that is dependent upon him and upon which he must bestow a sacred obligation. So Hermes ties man to the body. He ties man to the degree that man cannot escape except by perfection. He also implies that what we call ethical procedures, what we may term scientific methods, what we might broadly describe as such sciences as nutrition or physiology, or even anatomy, are really sciences by which man learns to become a good and just ruler of his own empire. Thus Hermes, in his book for the instruction of kings, writes not merely for those who rule nations, but for those who seek to exercise proper rulership over the compound structure of themselves. The man who is a despot to his own body will never attain the idealistic liberation which he hopes. Man must bring with him the least of himself, or remain behind with that which he has left imperfect. Man cannot depart from his humanity until he can take with him the total of the parts of himself. And this totality includes those parts which are extended into matter. Man, therefore, can cast off a physical body, but he cannot cast off his responsibility to body archetype. He can only bring it to perfection with himself. He cannot outgrow it. It must outgrow the need for him. And this it accomplishes through his assistance, through his wise and effective administration of that empire which is himself. By the next step, man, belonging to a society, must ultimately bring that society together. For there is no release from archetype except outgrowing of archetype. If, therefore, there be a complete archetype of humanity, there can be no true substantiation of this archetype, no total fulfillment of it, until all humanity occupies its proper relation to the archetypal pattern. This means that all differences between men must be overcome, that amity must be established. And until such time as this occurs, the continuance of differences requires the infinite continuance of an existing condition. There can be no change without remedy. There can be no release without growth. Man can escape from nothing, but he can outgrow everything except God. And when he outgrows all other things, he returns to God, who is the proper and internal source of growth. If then we conceive that reason is the shepherd of men, is that power by which the individual is enabled, first, to cognize his own existence, and second, recognize his own need. Reason, therefore, provides him with the indispensable instruments of his own salvation. He is saved not from ill, but from the state of not being saved, which in this is the common ill. For while man is not yet complete, he is torn between the imperfections of his knowledge and the internal inspirational impulses toward completeness. He is torn because prematurely completeness is not even attractive to him. Yet he cannot evade it. Therefore he is moved remorselessly along the way toward total enlightenment. And this emotion is universal. And we have some concern and agitation at the present time over the possibility that our present atomic researches may result in the decimation of our species. We are worried that we may cease before we are perfect. Let me warn you and assure you that your fears are groundless. Nothing can end its labors until it has completed the purpose for its own existence. Therefore, it is conceivable that man, by his ingenuity, might destroy a kind of world, might destroy a kind of race, might devastate a planet, might even force it from its orbit into chaos. But none of these, even so-called tragic things, can in any way change the requirements of man, for man surviving all vicissitudes is still responsible for the government of his empire, and somewhere space will provide him with the environment necessary to growth until growth is accomplished. Now, growth in this kind, the hermetic meaning of growth, as we find it in alchemy, certainly, is not exactly the kind with which we are familiar in the developing of garden plants or even in the upraising of the young. Growth is another kind of thing. Growth is a qualitative fulfillment. Growth is the thing becoming itself. It is that which removes all limitation upon self. Growth is not an addition of that which is not natural. Growth is the achievement only of that which is inevitable. A thing does not become necessarily more by growth. Rather, we may say it becomes whole by growth. Growth does not increase the number of the parts. It increases the unities of parts. Growth does not remove the evil of its own absence. It merely removes intervals by means of which things lose their dissimilarities and find it possible to reunite or to coalesce in a more complete and harmonious manner. Therefore, growth is an increasing awareness by means of which we are able to reconcile dissimilars and gradually come to the realization of identities. Growth in this same sense of the word generally appears to us as a means of enlarging our abilities. Actually, this is not the truth either. It is not the enlarging of the ability that is achieved any more than it is the increase of knowledge. What we have done is to overcome debility or disability. We have not added to knowledge because knowledge is eternal and knowledge is forever. And knowledge is total. But we have removed intervals between ourselves and knowledge. Therefore, growth is the setting up of a situation by which ever-increasing normalcy may be attained on the various levels in which growth is specified. Growth toward God is not a motion nor an enlargement. Growth toward God is a gradual removal of interval through realization, through understanding, and through the unfoldment of conscious powers. Hermes then gives us a universe in which all things are moving toward the completeness of their own parts, and in so doing, achieving what we like to term evolution. Evolution is really the overcoming of discords on all levels. The body becomes normal when its discords are overcome. Normalcy is not a remarkable state, nor is it a superior state. Normalcy is the natural state, which has been obscured by various forms of ignorance or excess. Man cannot create normalcy, but he can correct abnormalcy. Man cannot cure the sick, but he can remove the causes so far as possible by which sickness is able to endure. Health is not a particular end which men may sometime attain. Health is nature's norm, which by circumstances of one kind or another, sometimes obvious, sometimes subtle, sometimes caused by indiscretion, sometimes perhaps resulting from heroic self-sacrifice, but always sickness must result from the fact that normalcy, for one reason or another, has been unbalanced or has been prevented from manifesting itself. The person who works himself to death is a martyr, because actually is sacrificing normalcy, which is health, perhaps in a cause greater than himself. Still, however, he will be rewarded for the merit of the cause for which he worked, but he cannot escape the limitations imposed upon the flesh by its own laws. Therefore, all good men do not have to be healthy. But no man can be truly healthy who is not also the good man, having within himself a true and proper enlightenment concerning values. And health, in a way, is righteous government over the population of our material empire. And where it is endangered, we must rush to its assistance with every possible and available means. Not because we simply want to be well, but because we have an obligation to universal life, and we want to meet this obligation in every possible way that we can. Hermes then tells us something about punishment and reward. And here again, we may see traces and evidence of a relationship between old doctrines and new. Hermes had no concept of hell. The Egyptians did not know it as we understand the term. Most peoples of antiquity had but a dim vision of it. Some had a comparatively extravagant notion, but this only upon the outer surfaces of themselves. Their deeper and more mystical schools merely always recognized symbolical meaning rather than literal meaning. To Hermes, as to Plato, hell or perdition or punishment represented the condition of a soul in bondage. It represented the individual who had not gained ascendancy over the total economy of himself. That being who is not able to posit his rationality in such a way that it is his guide, his leader, and exercises a kind of determinism. The individual who is not master of certain processes of his own life must be regarded as a slave. And hell or punishment is slavery to mental, spiritual, or moral infirmity. Hell is the condition of the individual who lives without attempting to attain unity. Hell is the discord of diversity in function, in attitude. It is confusion. It is pandemonium. And it expresses itself most commonly in the most obvious and simple evidence of confusion, and that is fear. That individual who has not been able to establish value, has not established a core consciousness within himself, has not devoted his mind and his thought to such arts and sciences as give him dominion and at the same time give him earnest responsibility. Such a person must be under the condition of fear. Fear is unreasonable doubt concerning providence. Fear is founded in a belief in accidents. Fear exaggerates the power of things over principles. Fear is natural, where man, looking from himself, sees confusion and not unity. And furthermore, looking from himself, observes in the conflict of parts a variety of misfortunes, and further contemplates the possibility that he may himself be involved in these misfortunes. Therefore, fear must be in that mind which has not a goal, a purpose, or a plan. The mind which is aware of the principle of the universal creator cannot abide in fear. Therefore, one of the primary purposes of divine mind or universal reason is to bring man into a rational cognition of destiny, to reveal to man his inescapable place in a plan, that he is and must always be a creature of purpose, that truly in this plan, the plan itself cannot be solved, cannot be completed, cannot be consummated until fear ceases in every existing creature. one fearful creature leaves one part of the inevitable imperfect. Therefore, the very power which traditionally is said to mark the sparrow's fall, this same power decrees that in this universe there is nothing to fear but fear. And furthermore, that fear is proof that man has not attained inward penetration, that fear is the victory of defeatism over faith, that fear is the acceptance of division, whereas the achievement by rational illumination of the fact of unity relieves man from all unreasonable fear and places him in a universe of eternal progress in which he can never be less, but which he has the power through the unfolding of rational consciousness to become more, in the sense of having more awareness of that which is. Hermes then considers redemption, or the saving power of grace, as a kind of victory, not only of reason or rationality over fear, but of love over fear. Now, the difference between love and reason is of peculiar quality rather than essential nature, because the heart and the mind, originating in one source, must at their root be identical, though in their manifestations they appear divided. The reunion of these parts must also be attained in the course of the great hermetic experiment. In man, love is not merely the mutual affection, nor a kind of regard of one creature for another, nor is it based upon affection for outward appearances, nor even for mental or emotional attributes, nor for character alone. Love is of itself a kind of spiritual agent. It is a power. It is a transmuting force. And the reason for its tremendous value lies largely in the fact that it enables man to escape the pernicious pressure of egoism. Now, egoism has its place in the philosophic empire. Man must pass through the experience of self-existence. But having passed through this experience, he must not linger. For intensive egoism is bound to transform itself from a helpful factor at one stage of growth to a pernicious factor at another. Egoism, or egotism, helps man to gather the lesser parts of his own nature into an identity. Therefore, in himself, or as selfness, he brings his empire into one-pointedness. At the present time, this empire, like most political states, is not equally represented. At this time, there are not only unrepresented minorities, but there is the vast unrepresented majority. That, in this case, being man's egoism ignoring the requirements of his physiopsychical nature. Thus, man has turned his democracy into an autocracy and established egoism or egotism as a dictatorship of self-will over both body and environment. This is not the purpose, however. Ego must be tempered and must regain its sense of responsibility. It must realize that the one that would be greatest among parts must also be the servant of all, and that ego is never complete in its purpose until it has redeemed the least parts of its own compound nature. But having achieved the unity of internals, having brought its own parts into conformity, into uniformity, into final partnership, having diffused its own consciousness as a mystical experience through the cell structure of its own body, ego must then face a larger challenge, namely that it must sacrifice its own identity, or it can never achieve absolute identity with eternity. The world is not saved if 2,750,000,000 human egos remain separate beings. It may be saved from something less, but it is not saved from a greater need. Thus, egotism, resulting in innumerable egotistic institutions and structures, can ultimately frustrate archetype and can prevent the union of divided parts. Thus, beyond a certain point, ego must be released, relaxed, and allowed to escape from the driving power of necessity, which is its principal motivation. Ego, according to Hermes, was driven by necessity, an outrageous goddess. Necessity, in turn, forcing ego to certain attainments, ultimately forces ego to relinquish these attainments by a larger necessity. Necessity exists while man must struggle for survival. And the final symbol of this struggle is the survival of his individuality. Man must sometime, however, waken to the fact that the struggle for survival is an illusion, because it is utterly impossible for him not to survive. Survival, for him, however, does not have this broad philosophic implication. For most persons, survival means merely the continuance of a present state. Here, unhappily, ego is of little use, for it cannot preserve man from the changes of his estate, nor can it prevent change in nature. Thus, beyond a certain point, ego turns upon man and destroys him. And this is Bernie's concept of the fall of the angels. Lucifer representing ego, the brother of universal mind, rebels against heaven and is finally cast into the abyss by Michael, the psychopompous of the army of the Lord. Thus, ego must find, ultimately, either a voluntary relinquishment, or it forces the individual to an extremity in which a violent procedure seems to be the only possible course. Ego, however, by its own nature, is not too difficult if man will permit it to be itself. Ego is perfectly natural and perfectly normal in a situation. It is when it is moved out of that situation, or something is expected of it contrary to its own nature, or it is forced to preserve that which by its instinct it does not wish to preserve, then under the pressure of will, ego becomes a pernicious circumstance. The relinquishing of ego, therefore, becomes the higher discipline of Hermes, as it was in India, Egypt, China, Greece, and many other areas. The relinquishment of ego is the gradual breaking down of the barriers of mental isolation by which things are even more totally divided than they are by physical isolation. That thing is truly separate, which is mentally apart. And as surely as mental separation is a more terrible problem than physical, so surely mental union is a greater blessing than that of any other kind. Mental in this case does not mean intellectual, scholastic. Mental means union on the level of idea, union on the level of pure intellection. And the moment man is confronted with a challenge to depress the power of the ego, he finds an ever-present agent working for him and with him. And this agent is love. And love, according to Hermes, is one of the primary fields of the divine nature. For love of all things forces upon man the importance of the not-self. Love causes the individual, first of all, to place value above self. At first, symbolically, by transferring his attachment from himself to another. Love causes him to work industriously for a profit, not for himself, but for the objects of his affection. Love leads him into civilization. Love begins the restoration of unity by the establishment of the home. Love progresses this restoration by the foundation of the ecclesia, the assembly of those who are devoutly united in spirit. Love also gradually turns man from the adoration of things inferior to the veneration of things superior. Man unfolds and evolves from the fear of God to the respect for God. From respect he advances to admiration, from admiration to awe, and from awe finally to simple love. A love which transcends all of the more spectacular attitudes which he may hold. Thus man, seeking for final union, finds that even the mind itself, even cognition, even reason, the only begotten, is itself in a kind of lesser division from totality. And that which cannot be bridged by consciousness is bridged by complete self-forgetfulness in the service of that which the mystic Sufi calls the beloved. Thus man, unaware of his own motion, makes the final step to God by not even desiring the step, but by becoming completely immersed in total affection for that which is divine. By this means he does, through perfect love, achieve that unity which he first contemplates and later embraces by an inevitable gesture of his own desire. These in substance represent certain phases of the doctrine of Hermes which have to a measure Christian parallels. Parallels which are not always obvious, but I think we have selected those points in the Hermetic doctrine which have the greatest provocative power in causing us to consider or contemplate as to the possibility of an interplay, an interrelation between these doctrines. And also, we can also say, perhaps they indicate Christian influence on Hermeticism. In any respect, they represent universal beliefs or ideals which are expressed in the Hermetic writings and which prepare the way for the Shepherd of Men or the Great Discourse, in which Hermes, coming into the presence of universal reason, receives from reason the revelation which is the light of the world. And I think that covers our problem and our time for this evening, so we thank you very much.